This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, William Calvin, is a neurophysiologist. He studies brains, how they work, and how they've evolved. He sometimes assists during brain surgery. His new book, Conversations with Neil's Brain, tells us what brain surgery reveals about how the brain operates. The book chronicles an operation on an epileptic patient named Neil. The surgeon needs to remove the tissue causing the seizures without damaging the parts of Neil's brain that control language and motor skills. Neil is kept awake during part of the operation so that the surgeon can locate the language centers of the brain by stimulating parts of Neil's brain and testing Neil's responses.
You can't tell where the language regions are because they're so variable from patient to patient. There's no standard map that you can consult. Everyone's a bit different, and their language areas are quite a bit different. So you really have to test to find out where it is.
So that you don't end up messing up somebody's ability to speak or comprehend.
Yes. These surgeries are usually elective. I mean, they're not life-saving kinds of surgeries. And you certainly don't want to cause more trouble than you cure. And the main thing you really have to watch out for is language, and that you don't disturb it.
Why is it important to locate the language regions of the brain?
Well, first of all, they're right next door to where the epilepsy usually is. The epilepsy is usually located in these patients that are being operated on, in the temporal lobe, particularly in the front part of the temporal lobe. And language is all around this area, both right above it and certainly in back of it. And you don't really know where the language stops. That is to say, where if you remove that area surgically, you might cause the patient some language problems.
So you have to figure out a way how to remove the tissue that's causing the epileptic seizures without interfering with language functions.
Yeah, you have the same problem operating on tumors in this region too. And increasingly people are doing this kind of testing during tumor surgery as well. In the case of tumors, there's usually this overriding imperative to get rid of all of the tumor tissue so that it doesn't keep growing. In the epilepsy surgery, you don't have that problem. You can take away 80% of the troublemakers, and the other 20% probably won't be able to cause any trouble. You've got to figure out sort of what line it isn't safe to cross, and that's sort of a value judgment.
How do you map that out?
You map it out basically by getting the patient to talk, and then going around and stimulating and seeing what interferes with the talking. What you usually do is to show the patient a series of color slides of common objects, and the patient's been trained beforehand, knows all about how to do this. And so the patient will say, this is a ball, and the slide will change. You'll say, this is a dog, this is an elephant. He always says the phrase, this is a, in front of it. And when you stimulate, if you find an area that will interfere with naming, what the patient will say is, this is a, oh, I know what the name of that is, but it's, the patient can obviously talk, but he can't really come up with the name of the object until you take off the stimulating electrode, and then all of a sudden he'll say, it's an elephant. And the stimulation is simply interfering with the naming task. It's interfering with not only elephants, but also apples and dogs and balls and everything else. In each patient, there's perhaps a half dozen of these sites that are terribly sensitive for naming. If you move your stimulating electrode more than sort of a pencil width away from them, you won't interfere with the function anymore.
So you have to find the regions that are responsible for naming. What other language regions do you have to look for?
Well, certainly you want to know about reading, if you can. Sites for reading are often different. For example, you may find naming sites along the top of the temporal lobe, and in the gyrus right below it, sort of in the middle temporal lobe, you may find reading sites. In other patients, it goes just the opposite way. You'll find the reading sites up at the top and the naming sites along the middle. And those patients have different IQs. I mean, if you look at their verbal IQ scores, the ones that have the reading sites up on the top tend to have better than average verbal IQs. So there's a difference in brain organization for language that shows up in verbal IQ.
My guest is neurophysiologist William Calvin. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with William Calvin, author of the book Conversations with Neil's Brain, The Neural Nature of Thought and Language. Tell us about some of the other tests you would give a patient while probing different parts of the brain to find out where their language sites are.
Well, one of the things that you really want to know about is other regions like movement and skin sensation. In fact, those are the things that you check for first. The motor strip and the sensory strip are more reliably located, and once you know where they are, you have a bit of a feeling for where other things might be. So you certainly test those, but you can also test rather fancy kinds of sensory and motor function. For example, you can test the patient's ability to keep track of sounds in a sequence, the kinds of sequences that we use to pronounce words. You can test their ability to string together a series of movements, again, of the same kind that we might use to speak a word.
How would you test that?
Well, usually they're done with things that don't involve language at all, just because you'd like to find out whether the region has an underlying specialization that isn't language. I mean, we tend to call this area language cortex. But in fact, there's a lot of evidence that it has to do with the operation of the hands, that it has to do with the operation of stringing together various kinds of sequences of action that are not necessarily language. So what you tend to do to test the sequencing ability of the patient is to show them, for example, a color slide that has three different pictures on it of a actress acting out a series of facial expressions, you know, showing her teeth, pursing her lips, grinning, for example, might be the three pictures. And the patient's been rehearsed ahead of time and knows what to do with this. And so the patient first of all grins and then goes into baring his teeth and then goes into grinning. If you stimulate in this part of the brain, they'll get all fouled up doing that. They'll do one of them and they won't be able to go on doing the next, or they'll repeat one instead of going on to the next. This whole language area, at least the central part of it, you know, turns out to affect many kinds of sequential operations, not just language. So we've got a region here that's both sensory in the sense it does the same thing for sounds, if you test. And with about an 86% overlap, George Ogeman finds that these sites are also sequencing the movements, like the pursing of the lips and the baring of the teeth as well.
Do the tests that you do on somebody differ depending on whether they're left-handed or right-handed?
Certainly. The trouble is that left-handers are sort of a confusing issue because about half of them have brain organization very much like right-handers. Some of them have a completely backwards brain organization, and another group of them have a mixed up, what's called mixed dominance, where both sides of the brain are involved in doing language, for example. Those are the people who are more likely to stutter and have other problems. But we don't really know yet what this tie between handedness and language is all about. I mean, my guess is it's all about the sequencing area in the middle of the language area. That's what makes the other hand so dexterous in the first place. The sequencing area in the middle of language is also used not just to sequence the mouth and the tongue, but it's also used to sequence the hand and the arm, particularly the opposite side of the body, but also the same side.
You make it seem that left-handed people are a little disordered, that things don't aren't processed as neatly as right-handed people.
Well, there's a portion of the left-handers for which that's true. As I say, for about half of them, they have the same obvious brain organization as do the right-handers. And we don't really know why they're left-handed. As I say, there's this other group that have this completely reversed scheme of brain organization. But the group in the middle, the mixed dominance group, are what seem to try to do language out of both sides of the brain.
Is that a good thing to have it on both sides of the brain?
Well, probably not, judging from the pathology of it. I should back up and say that language, in some sense, is always done from both sides of the brain. It's just putting the words together or understanding the words someone else speaks tends to be pretty well localized to the left side in most of us. But the right side's involved with doing things like modulating the voice. I mean, my voice goes up and down at the end of a sentence and so forth. That's mostly right brain that's doing that. So the right brain's always involved in the act, particularly for sort of emotional nuances, the thing that sort of adds, you know, color and flavor to someone's voice and so that it isn't a monotone. Those are often being contributed by the right brain.
I guess it's remarkable to me that during part of brain surgery, you can be awake with just a local anesthetic and that your brain wouldn't be sensitive to pain.
Well, the brain itself doesn't have any sensitivity to pain. I mean, it reports it from elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the skin incision is potentially painful, but of course you use local anesthetics and such there. The bone itself doesn't have any pain endings in it, and the dura that covers the brain only rarely has pain endings in it, and the brain itself has no sensations reported from it. I mean, if you touch it with your gloved finger, the patient can't feel the touch.
How is the patient put back together again when the surgery is completed?
Well, it's a very routine matter. You know, basically, once they've made sure all the bleeding is stopped and everything's nice and stable and rinsed out and such, the dura, this sort of thick covering over the surface of the brain, it's sort of you know, like white parchment, except it's flexible. You first of all sew it back together very tightly. There's initially sort of a U-shaped incision so that you can sort of fold a flap of it back. And basically you sew up the sides of that U. You don't put anything in the missing space. The cerebral spinal fluid fills it up eventually. But then putting the bone back in is a matter of you wire it back in place. The whole big piece of bone about the size of the palm of your hand is taken out. And that's put back in with about four or five wires like hairpins through little holes in the skull and in the bone. And those are twisted down and snipped off. And that holds the piece of bone quite firmly. There's a couple of about four or five holes that, about dime size that you've drilled in order to get the saw in to cut this opening. And those are filled up with an acrylic that sets up in just a couple of minutes and becomes firm. But over the course of the next couple of weeks, the saw cuts heal over because the bone actually grows out and bridges the gap. So in another few months, the whole thing's really grown back together into a hole, and the little pieces of wire are still in there, but they're not doing anything. Closing up after you've got the bone in place is just a matter of stitching the muscle insertion back into place so that it too will grow back. And then closing up the scalp, which is all pretty much sewing.
If there were one question that you could answer about the brain through your research, do you know what that question would be?
Certainly it would be in how we plan ahead. Because planning ahead is so much what makes us different from the other animals. I mean, we tend to say it's language, and I think our language abilities have a lot to do with our planning ahead abilities. But all of our abilities to foresee the future and to make estimates, basically, of what will happen if we do this, how will other people react? That's the basis for our morality, our ethics, all of those things. And, you know, without that plan ahead ability, we really are a little more than a talking ape. And that ability to sort of think about tomorrow and what it might bring is really the part of the brain I would most like to know how it does that.
William Calvin's new book is called Conversations with Neil's Brain. This is Fresh Air.